On a Monday, it is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. We are breaking down developments at the Capitol in this order, starting with Attorney General Josh Call and how he says hundreds of millions of dollars could be at stake in lawsuit settlements that require the legislature's budget committee to approve. And we're looking at who might make a run for Congress after recent news that Representative Jim Sensenbrenner won't run again. And Representative Sean Duffy is resigning a week from today. So what are your thoughts on the states, including Wisconsin, that are suing Purdue Pharma, by the way, just declared bankruptcy, alleging that it helped cause the opioid crisis? Do you think that we should settle our lawsuit against Purdue? Laurel White is Wisconsin Public Radio State Capitol reporter. She reports on many of the moving parts at the Capitol, and you can find her co-hosting the WPR Politics podcast. Laurel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
So let's start with Purdue here. Last week, State Attorney General Josh Call declined to join a group of states settling lawsuits that they filed against Purdue Pharma over its alleged role in the opioid crisis. Why did Call decide the settlement wasn't satisfactory for Wisconsin?
So when Call released a statement, he essentially said that he just doesn't find this to be a sufficient measure of how much influence the Sackler family and Purdue Pharma has had, in his opinion, on the opioid epidemic across the country. So in his statement, he said, quote, "The Sackler family has made billions of dollars from the sale of opioids. Wisconsin has alleged that two Purdue Pharma entities and Richard Sackler contributed to the opioid epidemic through unlawful conduct. We're committed to getting justice, and in my view, Purdue's current position doesn't achieve that." So I know that Call is not alone in this. There are a number of attorneys general across the country that are also pushing back on this proposed settlement. And I think part of their pushback is they don't believe that the Sackler family personally has enough skin in the game, that they're using enough of their personal fortune to back up this settlement. And they also believe that some of the estimates of the value of the company, kind of moving pieces like that, aren't incredibly accurate. They think that maybe some assets are overvalued. And so when the money is actually paid out, it's not going to be as much as has been promised.
Well, meanwhile, we're hearing reports this morning that Purdue Pharma has declared bankruptcy. So what's next for Wisconsin and other states that decided this recent settlement wasn't good enough?
So this is obviously a very dynamic process. A judge is going to weigh in on the validity of the proposed settlement so far, how the bankruptcy weighs into that. So we're certainly, as we often seem to in the Capitol, we're waiting for a judge's decision on this moving forward.
Well, let's step back here and look at the lame duck law. Last month, the Joint Finance Committee had a meeting where Attorney General Josh Call asked members to sign these non-disclosure agreements in a closed-door meeting, which apparently they declined to do. And it turns out Call wanted to talk about the Purdue settlement. So help us understand what went on in the background here.
So this is a very complicated situation that's really been evolving over the past several weeks in Wisconsin. We did get confirmation last week that the Purdue settlement was the settlement of tremendous importance. That's the way his office characterized it, that the Joint Finance Committee was set to discuss several weeks ago. That meeting came to a grinding halt when Call asked lawmakers to sign non-disclosure agreements so he could share information about the pending settlement. Lawmakers refused to sign those agreements, and that kind of set off a negotiation that's still ongoing about how the attorney general is supposed to discuss these pending cases and meet, in his view, legal requirements for confidentiality, and lawmakers on the other side meeting their needs for transparency and public accountability as they weigh in on these lawsuits.
We're working through developments at the Capitol with Laurel White. She's WPR State Capitol reporter. A lame duck law requires the attorney general to get approval from Joint Finance before he decides to settle certain suits. So do you agree with this law? Do you think the attorney general should have buy-in from lawmakers before settling some lawsuits? Or should this extra step be eliminated over concern it could stall settlement money coming into our state, flowing into our state? 800-642-1234. You can join in, email ideas at WPR.org. Laurel, where does this leave us? Because Attorney General Josh Call didn't follow the lame duck law. He didn't get the approval of Joint Finance Committee before settling a lawsuit. So what happens in the attorney general's power to settle lawsuits?
So really, we're in kind of a stalemate right now, Kate. I mean, there isn't an apparatus set up as of right now for the attorney general to bring these cases before the Finance Committee and discuss them. Essentially, what situation we're in is lawmakers say we should be able to talk about these things. You talk about these things with other parties, including the governor. They've also expressed some frustration that the Purdue case is now in the media. They said Call issued a statement about the case to reporters. Did reporters sign a confidentiality agreement? They put that question out into the world last week. So there's certainly been a lot of back and forth on this issue that hasn't changed. And so as of right now, there's really no way for the attorney general to settle a lawsuit if he wants to. If he's going to follow this law, he has to get approval from the committee before he can settle anything. So as this Purdue case moves forward, say there's a change that makes it more palatable to the attorney general. He wants to go ahead and settle the case, which could bring millions into the state of Wisconsin. He would need to find a way to discuss that and get that approval from the Finance Committee before he was able to do that. And the same can be said for lots of other cases that are currently before the Department of Justice that can't be settled under the current structure.
Yeah, what kind of backlog are we looking at here? Are there other cases?
There are a number of other cases. More than 15 cases, according to the State Department of Justice, are kind of in a holding pattern right now because of this disagreement. Some of those cases are smaller, kind of in terms of if you put them on a spectrum with Purdue Pharma, which many things are small when you're on a spectrum with that kind of case. But there are state cases that have to do with Medicaid payouts and insurance companies, bills that the state is trying to get reimbursed for from those insurance companies. Then you have some other fraud cases that are kind of stepping up into the millions of dollars that the state has proposed settlements out there for. And of course, there are these other multi-state settlements out there other than Purdue Pharma that could come before the attorney general at any time.
Well, let's bring in a call on this. Jane in Suamico. Hi, Jane.
Hello. My comment is that it's really distressing to me because the Republicans, again, are using taxpayer dollars to hire attorneys for hundreds of dollars to defend what to me is an indefensible position. If they're going to say they're responsible for making these settlement decisions, to me, they have to honor the same kind of confidentiality that the attorney involved in the case has to honor.
Jane, thanks for those thoughts. What would you say there, Laurel?
So there, I think it's important to note there that there are multiple private lawyers kind of at play here when we talk about the lame duck laws writ large and then this particular provision. Of course, the lame duck laws are moving through the courts in Wisconsin. The entire session has been challenged in several lawsuits that are moving before federal courts and the state Supreme Court. We're waiting for arguments in one of those cases coming up pretty soon. So there are private lawyers obviously in question there, but there's also a private lawyer that's been hired by Republican lawmakers on the Joint Finance Committee. They thought that was a way to move forward in this kind of confidentiality stalemate. They hired a lawyer. He signed agreements on behalf of the committee. They said they thought that would be binding, but that wasn't sufficient for the attorney general. So there are a lot of private lawyers involved in this dispute.
Breaking down developments at the Capitol, taking them one at a time with WPR State Capitol reporter Laurel White. Are you watching the two congressional races in Wisconsin to replace U.S. Representatives Sean Duffy and Jim Sensenbrenner? Are there any candidates you want to see run or want information on their status? 800-642-1234. We'll get back to the State Cap in a moment on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're slowing down the politics, getting at the heart of the issues, including who will run for Congress to fill upcoming seats being vacated by Representatives Jim Sensenbrenner, who says he won't seek another term, and Representative Sean Duffy, who is set to resign next week. Are you watching the two congressional races in Wisconsin? Do you think State Senator Tom Tiffany has a chance? Do you think Duffy's seat will stay Republican, or do you think it will flip Democrat? Join in. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Laurel White is our guide. She is WPR's state capitol reporter. So, Laurel, let's talk about the upcoming congressional elections. We saw Leah Vukmir, a Republican who has a long track record in the Wisconsin legislature, announced she won't be running next year for the U.S. House seat being vacated by Representative Sensenbrenner. So what's the significance of that?
So I think this is a particularly significant announcement because Vukmir was considered sort of a front runner in this race, at least in terms of the extent that there can be a front runner this early in the process. I think she was considered that way because she has had recent campaign experience and kind of a statewide name recognition. She was the Republican candidate in the U.S. Senate race in the last general election. She ran against Senator Tammy Baldwin, obviously wasn't successful in that race, but had a campaign apparatus set up, had a lot of name recognition with Republican voters across the state. So I think Vukmir bowing out of this race kind of creates a little bit different dynamic for some of the others that are staying in.
So what is she doing these days?
So Vukmir is now working for the National Taxpayers Union, which is a conservative advocacy group. And in her statement where she kind of outlined a little bit about why she's not looking to get into this race now, she said, I'm enjoying this work. I'm able to spend a little bit more time with my family. And that's what I'm choosing to prioritize right now.
So Vukmir aside, is there anyone else we know who is eyeing the seat?
Absolutely. There are still a number of people interested in this seat. This is a really high profile seat. This is kind of this district is kind of the hotbed of Republican politics in Wisconsin, a very safe conservative district, and where a lot of power players in the Republican Party apparatus for the state are actually from. So we do have the state Senate Majority Leader, Scott Fitzgerald, somebody I talk about a lot and cover a lot at the state capitol. He is still considering a bid. Some people think he's pretty darn serious. He released a new Twitter handle last week that Fitzgerald for WI for we. So people are kind of pointing to that and saying, oh, he's running, but no official announcement yet. Then there are a couple little bit interesting candidates in the race in terms of first time candidates. Matt Walker, son of former Governor Scott Walker, says he's considering a bid. And also the son of a former Walker opponent, Matt Newman, who's the son of Mark Newman, who ran against Governor Walker in 2010, is considering a bid. So we could have a Walker-Newman repeat race, just with the sons this
time.
With
the son, next generation.
That's right.
Well, let's shift gears here and look at another race. This one is for Wisconsin's 7th Congressional District. We've learned Representative Sean Duffy announced his resignation last month. And Republican State Senator Tom Tiffany announced last week that he'd be running for that seat. What do we have as an update there?
So Tiffany is still the only announced candidate in that race. He is a state senator that has represented that district for quite a while. So he has some good name recognition in that area. I think what's interesting about the 7th district is it is an incredibly large congressional district in Wisconsin. Tiffany or any other candidate that gets in the race has a lot of geography to cover and has a lot of work to do in terms of reaching out to constituents in all these different areas and kind of drumming up that name recognition. But I think somebody like Tiffany, who has very strong name recognition in his particular district, has a little bit of a leg up compared to some others.
And here is Senator Tiffany talking about his announcement speech last week.
Nancy Pelosi is salivating about a low turnout special election to flip a seat in Trump country. She is counting on us being divided. Let's come together in the coming months to keep this seat red.
So keep the seat red, Laurel. What's the national significance of this seat?
So this is a really interesting race, and I think one that is going to have some national attention moving forward. And that's because Democrats are eyeing this as a potential flip. What they're pointing to there is actually a little bit back in time. They're pointing to the 2012 presidential election, where President Barack Obama lost to Republican candidate Mitt Romney by just 3 points in the district. So they're saying this is an area that can have a close race between Democrats and Republicans, and they're not ready to kind of give up hope on that. They also point to the fact that a Democratic representative, Representative Dave Obey, represented that district for more than 4 decades. So there's a strong history of Democratic representatives in that area, and they'd really like to flip it back.
Talking with Laurel White, she's WPR's state capitol reporter, joins us most Mondays for a roundup. What are your thoughts on the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty's criticism of the Evers administration? Is it true that the governor could be more transparent and forthcoming with open records requests? Join in at 800-642-1234. Laurel, moving on, Andrew Hitt, the chairman of the state Republican Party, said last week that these congressional races will help President Trump get reelected since they'll boost Republican turnout. Could these races impact the upcoming presidential election? Is there a tie?
Well, I think that's a really interesting point and something that's kind of flipped on its ear from what we normally hear. We normally hear about the top of the ticket sort of boosting turnout for the bottom of the ticket, right? So President Trump kind of helping these lower candidates get their votes that they need to get over the top. So I think Hitt is bringing up a different dynamic here. I think it is really interesting, though. We heard Tiffany talk about how Nancy Pelosi is, quote unquote, salivating about low turnout in the district. I think because of kind of that national attention about potentially flipping the 7th, the dialogue there, the interesting dynamic of a special election before the general that's going to take place, there's going to be a lot of attention on these races that's a little bit different. And so maybe Hitt does have a point that some of these lower races down the ticket, down ballot races are going to be particularly motivational for Republican voters this cycle.
Switching gears here, the conservative group Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty came out with a report last week saying that the Evers administration is, quote, disorganized and dysfunctional, unquote, when it comes to handling open records requests. Can you tell us what's going on there with open records?
So the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty and a number of other conservative groups have been pretty critical of the Evers administration from the outset in terms of how they handle open records requests, the media outlets that they invite to legislative briefings and press conferences. So this isn't an incredibly unexpected pushback that we're getting from Will here. Basically, what they're saying is Governor Evers isn't doing what Governor Walker did for open records in Wisconsin. They're looking at it through the lens of two executive orders that Governor Walker put out on open records, a state website that the Walker administration administered that tracked open records requests, what the request was, how long it took to fulfill, things like that. That's not something that the Evers administration has continued. And so Will says because the Evers administration hasn't been following those same standards, it has really fallen behind and isn't doing what it should to ensure transparency for the people of Wisconsin. Now, the Evers administration has really pushed back on that. And they said, no, we're not following the executive orders of a previous governor, but we're following state laws related to open records. And so their argument is what we're doing is incredibly sufficient to make sure that there's that, you know, proverbial sunshine that everybody wants on state practices. We're just not doing it in the same way as the previous administration.
Are we seeing any litigation on this front at all to press transparency?
Not on this particular issue. There has been litigation from other conservative groups about some other things that the governor has done in terms of who's invited to press conferences, for example, and things like that. So I don't think beyond this particular allegation, this is something that we're going to hear the end of anytime soon.
Well, let's look ahead to the rest of the week. It's merely Monday. What should we be paying attention to?
So we're obviously going to keep a really close eye on these two congressional districts, looking to see who's announcing whether they're getting in or getting out of this race. That's a really closely watched thing. And as we talked about with Vukmir, one person deciding to step away really changes the dynamic. So keeping a close eye on those things. We have some legislative hearings, some committee hearings on different proposals at the Capitol this week.
One related to police body cameras.
Absolutely. That's tomorrow. That has to do with the documentation from those body cameras, how it's shared, who it's available to, how long it's stored. There's been some concerns from, again, open records advocates about how that's handled and how to balance that with police departments and their procedures. So we'll have some details on that for you tomorrow.
Laurel, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Laurel White is State Capitol reporter for WPR. She co-hosts the WPR Politics podcast. Coming up, Public Service Commissioner Chairperson Rebecca Cameron Bach joins us to discuss Wisconsin's energy policies and the work of the three-member commission. You have a line for her, to her. What questions do you have about the Wisconsin PSC? What do you want the chairperson to know? 800-642-1234 to join in. We'll talk with her after this news update here on the Ideas Network. On a Monday, you're with us for the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you have a line to the chair of the Public Service Commission. The utility industry is facing a number of challenges today. The business of producing and distributing energy is changing, and that means regulators have new issues before them. The Wisconsin Public Service Commission has three members. Commissioners are appointed by the governor, confirmed by the state Senate for staggered six-year terms. So what questions do you have about the Wisconsin PSC and its role? We're at 800-642-1234. Rebecca Cameron Bach is the chairperson of the Wisconsin Public Service Commission. In January, she was appointed by Governor Tony Evers to a six-year term as commissioner. And previously, she was a partner at the law firm Quarles & Brady in its Energy, Environment, and Natural Resources Group. She represented clients such as utility companies, energy developers, and alternative energy suppliers. Commissioner Bach, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, often in the headlines, the Wisconsin Public Service Commission is taking a very important vote. Give us, pull back the veil a bit. Give us a day in the life of the PSC. Walk us through what the three commissioners do and how you interact with each other.
So it's really interesting, and having practiced in the energy law field for, about 20 years before I was appointed to this position, I had certain misconceptions that have been cleared up since I took the position in January. It's actually a pretty isolating position to be in because of Wisconsin's open meetings laws. If two of us are together, that's considered a walking quorum. So we're not allowed to deliberate outside of an open meeting, and that open meeting then the agenda has to be posted within 24 hours of us meeting. So if two of us are speaking to each other in the office, during the day, we're talking about things like baking cookies and going on vacations. We're not allowed to talk about substantive matters, and we're not allowed to talk about substantive matters until we get into that open meeting. So sometimes when the three of us get to the open meeting and one of us starts talking about an issue, the other two, we are sort of surprised about, I hadn't thought about that particular line of reasoning. Let's pull on that thread a little bit. So it's interesting, but from a day-to-day perspective, it's a lot of meetings with inside staff and outside parties, but not a whole lot of interaction between the commissioners themselves.
So when you deliberate on the things that are coming at you in these meetings, you're deliberating by yourself in isolation unless you're meeting in an open meeting setting with the commissioners.
Right. Correct. So it's a little, we're sort of a quasi-judicial agency that we speak through our orders, and our final written orders are the decisions of the commission. So it can be a little bit confusing, I think, to members of general public. Because when you think about the Supreme Court can confer. They're allowed to speak to each other, but we are not. So when we have pretty high profile cases, none of us knows how the other is going to vote. None of us knows how the other has looked at the issues until we get into that open meeting.
You were appointed, of course, here by Governor Tony Evers, but your fellow commissioners were appointed by former Governor Scott Walker. How are you working together? Are you finding some common ground as you look at these issues before you?
We are. And, you know, I've long believed that energy industry, the energy industry and the topics that are facing the energy industry are independent of politics. And I get it, you know, we're political appointees, but the issues that we're looking at and the cases that we are deciding, there's no politics in those cases and in those issues. And I think if you look back over the last 8 months of decisions that have come out, they're largely majority opinions or unanimous opinions where it's 3-0.
Well, let's bring in a call now. Tom joining us from Viroqua. Hi, Tom.
Yes, good morning. Good morning, Chairman Bach. Back in the 80s, Wisconsin had one of the most progressive energy efficiency programs in the country under a least cost long-range planning process as modeled by Dr. Amory Lovins. As part of deregulation in the mid-90s, This program, which had strong public service oversight assuring success of it, was taken away from the utilities in a public benefits program that all of us ratepayers pay into on our monthly bill. Since that time, specifically coming around 2005, that authority to run these programs was taken by the Public Service Commission and given to a group called the Statewide Energy Efficiency and Renewable Administration. This is, as far as I can find, a very secretive body that doesn't operate under open meetings laws. They tend to just farm out the programs that we have for efficiency and renewables to large outside bodies with no real oversight. And my essential question is, why is it, as far as I can tell, this group CERA is totally made up of high-level utility executives with no representation whatsoever from any of the other stakeholders?
Tom, thanks for the question. Let's give the chairman some possibility here to answer that. Chairman Bach?
Sure. So as the caller indicated, CERA is a creature of the legislature, and it's actually overseen by members of the Office of Energy Innovation that's housed at the Public Service Commission. So there continues to be oversight. The legislature saw it fit to sort of set up CERA as a body that represented additional interest beyond just commission staff to look at how energy efficiency dollars would be spent. And while they don't deliberate at open meetings, that is a true statement. I will say that the Public Service Commission still does have input because we ultimately are the ones who are approving the energy efficiency awards and the grants that come out of the recommendations from CERA and from the Office of Energy Innovation. So while it may seem to the public that there's no longer any oversight, there definitely is because we three commissioners are the ultimate decision makers.
We're talking with the chair of the Wisconsin Public Service Commission, Rebecca Cameron Vock. What questions do you have about how the PSC works, how it deliberates? Do you live near a natural gas or coal-fired power plant? What's your experience been like? What is your take on this form of energy? Do you think the state will be carbon-free by 2050? Join in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. You were a regulatory attorney at We Energies for almost 15 years, and that is our state's largest utility. You understand how to defend utility companies, but Critics are concerned whether you will have the ear of customers and ratepayers as you deliberate issues before the PSC. How do you respond to that concern?
Sure, I can understand that. But my response is that actually makes me extremely uniquely qualified to understand the impact on the customers. So during my time at We Energies, I rotated through to different parts of the company. So I worked in a power plant, I worked in customer service, I worked on the energy trading floor, all to get a better understanding of the business side. And working my way through the company gave me such a finer appreciation for the impact that energy companies have on their customers. So I understand there are nuances to rate making, there are nuances to tariffs that I can grab onto, and I can ask further questions because I understand it, because it's my background. And, you know, similar to when attorneys are appointed to the bench, we have ethical obligations that when we are representing our clients, we're representing them to the best of our ability, but we're also ethically bound to be impartial. And so as a commissioner, I think it's actually a benefit because I understand the nuances of the industry.
Bob in Clay Banks has a question. Hi, Bob. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having this show. I was wondering what the reasoning was behind not having these meetings open to the public.
So Bob is wondering, why aren't meetings open to the public, Chairman Vock?
The CIRA meetings or the regularly scheduled open meetings? Because the open meetings are open to the public.
Okay, no, I'm not looking for information on the open ones. I'm looking for information on the closed ones.
So the CIRA is an independent board created by the legislature. And they don't have open meetings, the open meetings rules that apply to that particular board. But when the ultimate decision on energy efficiency grants is made, those are made in open meetings by the three commissioners.
Why aren't they open?
You'd have to ask the legislature.
Bob, thanks for the call. You know, Governor Evers signed this executive order recently to become 100% carbon free by 2050. Do you agree that Wisconsin's electric grid needs to change to accommodate carbon free electricity?
I do. And I always want to make it clear that this is a goal. It's not a mandate. There's been no legislative change to the state's renewable portfolio standard. That remains as it has. I think that the energy providers and customers have led the charge in this area. Their customers are demanding that their energy continue to be safe, reliable, and affordable, but now you're seeing an increased demand that energy also come from clean energy sources. And to their credit, all of Wisconsin's largest investor-owned utilities have come out with their own zero carbon goals. Xcel has pledged to be at zero by 2050. So I do think it's possible. Now, I think there's a gap.
And let's pause right there with the gap as we talk with the chair of the Public Service Commission, Rebecca Cameron Vock, what about issues before the three-member commission, including carbon-free issue. You can join in 800-642-1234. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. It's the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and if you're just joining us, we're talking with the chair of the Public Service Commission. Rebecca Cameron Vock was appointed by Governor Evers in January as commissioner at the PSC for a six-year term. What questions do you have about how the PSC works? What do you want the chair of the commission to know? Do you live near a coal-fired power plant or a natural gas plant? What's your experience been like? What's your take on future forms of energy? Join in at 800-642-1234. And PSC Chair Rebecca Cameron Vock stays with us. As you were saying, they're talking about becoming carbon free by 2015. There is a gap. What does that gap look like?
Well, so with the advent of utility scale solar and wind, those are oftentimes referred to as intermittent sources of energy, right? Because if the sun's not shining and the wind's not blowing, you're not getting electricity produced from those particular facilities. So you need something that's going to bridge those technologies. You're going to need something. A lot of people talk about battery storage as being that technology. And while right now that seems to be the front runner, we just don't know. We don't know, and we don't. It's not advanced enough for us to completely get rid of baseload generation right now, because we don't have the technology available to fill those gaps when the sun's not shining or when the wind isn't blowing. And I also, when we talk about getting to zero carbon, we can't ignore the impact that the transportation sector has on carbon emissions. It's only been within the last year that as carbon emissions from the electric generation sector have continued to come down, we're not making that big of a bump in the transportation sector. So really getting to zero carbon as a society, we're going to have to continue on ways to get the transportation emissions down as well.
Gloria from Montfort called in and wants to know if you have a strong inclination to represent the public here. Is the rate, Gloria asks, going to be going up for ratepayers in Wisconsin? Who's on their side, she asks.
Well, certainly Citizens Utility Board is an active and engaged advocate for the customer. They also were created by the legislature. At our open meeting last week, the three of us unanimously approved a $300,000 grant for CUB to use in its next fiscal year. But certainly every single time I'm presented with a case, I'm looking at the impact on customers. I'm looking at the impact on the reliability of the grid. I'm looking at the impact on the environment if it has to do with emissions. So there's a very strict set of guidelines that we as commissioners have to consider when we're deliberating, and I take that very seriously. And we do have active participation on behalf of industrial customers and commercial customers and residential customers as well. That all gets into the record, and it all gets paid very close attention by not just me, by all three of us.
I understand you can't speak specifics about particular cases, but the Public Service Commission approved the construction of the Cardinal Hickory Creek transmission line last month. That's that 100-mile long going through Dane County, Dubuque County, Iowa. You know, outside of this case, what does the PSC take under consideration when you have a $500 million transmission pipeline that is proposed?
So we take everything that's on the record into consideration, everything that's on the record. And in addition to that, we have opportunities for public comment. I personally sat and participated and listened to a number of those public hearings. But you don't have to be there to have access to that information. Every single comment that gets received gets put on our record. We all have binders and binders of information. We've got written testimony. We have the transcript from the technical hearings. We have every single public comment that has been filed. There are data requests, which is a way to ask questions outside of the actual hearing. The responses to those data requests are also part of the record. So whether it's a high-profile transmission line or a change to a particular tariff that the utility is requesting and everything in between, we read the entire record. And then when you get through reading the entire record, we as commissioners have the ability to ask questions. We have briefings with our staff. We ask staff to get answers if we have questions about certain issues. And then all of that information has to be digested, it has to be read, and you have to balance everything that's in front of you and then apply the applicable statutory provision to come to your decision.
We're talking with Rebecca Cameron Vox. She is chairperson of the Wisconsin Public Service Commission, a three-member body. Let's go to Jimmy now, joining us from Valley Junction with a question. Hi, Jimmy.
Well, good morning. I was just wondering if there's any discussion of nuclear power in the future going ahead if we're going to get to zero carbon emissions. I would think that would be an option since it's zero carbon. I know there's a lot of concern about not in my backyard, just like there are with other power plants, but I was wondering if that was part of the plan, and I'll take my comments off the air.
Thank you, Jimmy. Chairperson Vock, what do we know about nuclear?
Well, we know that in Wisconsin, they lifted the moratorium on nuclear. So for a number of years, there was a moratorium on any new nuclear being built in Wisconsin, and that restriction was removed a couple of years ago. I say oftentimes that in order for us to get to zero carbon, we've got to look at all of the above. And I consider nuclear to be part of all of the above. You do hear about it when you attend regional and national conferences. There's research, and there is a fair amount of talk about what does nuclear look like this time around. But I certainly don't dismiss it. I consider it to be, you know, a carbon-free way to produce energy. I just don't know, given the long timeline and the extremely high capital costs associated with nuclear plants, I'm just not sure if we'll see another one built.
Well, let's pause here on energy and look at broadband, another huge issue in Wisconsin. Our state's infrastructure consistently ranking near the bottom of states in our country. Last year, Wisconsin ranked 32nd for internet access in the U.S. What needs to be done to improve broadband connectivity, and what is the PSC doing about it?
So I ask that very question all the time, and the answer is we need more dollars. In this particular budget, that the governor made a historic investment in broadband, and there's $48 million available over the biennium. We just announced the first round of $24 million available in grants. We are asking for applications to be filed by December 19th, 2019. But when you talk to providers and when you talk to companies who are building the infrastructure, it really is. It's about capital costs, because if you have a mile or a mile and a half between customers, that's a mile and a half of fiber or of cable that's being run, and it's hard to get your return on investment if you can't get enough people to hook into that line. And I think I'm appreciative that the legislature agrees that this is an area that needs attention, and we need to continue to fund it.
Because it sounds like it comes down to fundamental economics here. Not enough customers to plug in.
Exactly. That's exactly right. Exactly. And so the more we can help from a state perspective, and also earlier in the year, the governor submitted a letter to the USDA to make it easier for agricultural parties to apply for USDA broadband grants, because, you know, precision agriculture has now driven a need for better access to broadband. Telemedicine, you see it everywhere, so it's necessary, but we've got to be able to leverage as many dollars as possible.
Chairperson Vock, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Rebecca Cameron Vock is chair of the Wisconsin Public Service Commission. Just ahead, we're learning about a Minnesota company that tried to outsource part of its production across the border in Wisconsin, circumventing legacy pollution. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the State Capitol Report on the Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.